The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Bhikkhu Bodhi. The human mind is not a hermetically sealed chamber enclosing a personality unalterably shaped by biology and early experience. Rather, throughout life, it remains a highly malleable entity, continually remodeling itself in response to its social interactions. Our regular and repeated social contacts implicate us in a constant process of psychological osmosis that offers precious opportunities for growth and transformation. Like living cells engaged in a chemical dialogue with their colleagues, our minds transmit and receive a steady barrage of messages and suggestions that may work profound changes even at levels below the threshold of awareness. It is because he perceived how susceptible our minds can be to the influence of our companions that the Buddha repeatedly stressed the value of good friendship in the spiritual life. So we begin here with Bhikkhu Bodhi and a suggestion that, we are permeable and probably more suggestible than we tend to imagine. And the kind of social influences are profound. And so spiritual friendship is, I would say, both a cause of our well-being and also an effect of our well-being. We need good influences. We need to be constantly reminded of wisdom and love. That's part of what friendship is, a kind of steady stream of reminders that the kind of North Star of our Dharma life can easily recede behind clouds. We need reminders. Every time it happens 1,000 times a day, we become alienated from Dharma. We need reminders. The reminders sometimes come in the form of another being, the gaze of the other, the words of the other, the love of the other. And then spiritual friendship is also an effect of our well-being. The more healed our heart is, the more deeply, intimately familiar we are with our inner landscape, the more the opportunities open for intimate spiritual friendship, connection. And so friendship serves many functions in our lives, and it's a very famous paper from 30 years ago, sort of like one of the most cited papers in psychological literature. I think it was titled "The Need to Belong," where they argued that essentially, like much of the way society is organized, it's organized around meeting the need to belong. And here at Berkeley, there's an institute, John A. Powell's Institute, the Institute for Othering and Belonging. Very beautiful name for a think tank. Yeah. Othering and Belonging. So these authors, Baumeister and others, say human beings are fundamentally and pervasively motivated by a need to belong. The desire for interpersonal attachment may well be one of the most far-reaching integrative constructs available to understand human nature. At a psychoanalytic conference in England in 1940, D.W. Winnicott said, I think started the lecture as the story goes, there is no such thing as a pediatrician and, you know, psychoanalyst and theorist of early childhood, and starts the lecture, there is no such thing as a baby. And then, you know, there's only a baby and their caretaker, a baby and he said baby and their mother. You know, like proportionally humans spend, like compared to other mammals, we spend like the longest time growing up proportionally to our lifespan. And as babies, I don't mean to laugh at babies, but they are almost comically unprepared for the task of life, you know. It's just like the dependence is so radical, you know. It's like so complete is their need for love. And that is where, you know, life unfolds from, is the kind of interpersonal matrix of care and love and intersubjective exchange. And so our being is forged in this interpersonal realm, and we can say, like, empathy gives life. That's it. Ajahn Sajito, in the cramped state of limited empathy, we assume we're solitary beings. However, this is just not true. We needed parents to be conceived, medical support to get born. As we grow up, we do so dependent on the resources of a shared planet and the culture and infrastructure of the society we dwell in. If that isn't deeply sensed with the accompanying sense of respect, responsibility, and gratitude, this is ignorance. Respect, responsibility, and gratitude. And yet we've entered a time of a significant isolation, which is not the same as loneliness, but maybe that too, but certainly a significant isolation. Exacerbated by COVID pandemic, but predated that. And read that the rate of loneliness among young adults is apparently it's increased every single year from 1976 until 2019. And an essay, but Derek Thompson, Antisocial Century, said in-person socialization has declined dramatically over the past 20 years. Meetings from home, he writes, shop at home, entertain at home, eat at home, worship at home. The UK has a minister for loneliness, as does Japan. The phenomenon, he writes, the entire economy has reoriented itself to allow Americans to stay within their four walls. This phenomena cannot be reduced to remote work. It's something far more totalizing, something more like remote life. And all that, you know, and this is not universally true for sure, but some of the atomization, the isolation, can erode, the essay argues, erode the sense of neededness, to feel needed within the lives of others. And I noticed that over, you know, the course of the pandemic, like I mean, I'm always, I know it's a little strange, but I'm shy, you know, and to be up here or whatever, but I am shy. And over the kind of course of the pandemic, I noticed like my social skills with like neighbors decayed on a monthly basis, kind of, you know, just sort of like a little that kind of, you know, and they don't know how much I love them. I'm just shy. I'm just like really awkward. And that was a diversion. That was a little digression. So the Buddha was not a couples counselor or family therapist or organizational consultant, but knew a lot about Sangha and friendship and harmony and most everything in the Buddhist tradition in one way or another is good for social life, social relationship. Most everything we do in this inner work opens the space for deeper, more radical, fulfilling connection, opens the space to fulfill the needs of others more completely. So sometimes we say Kalyanamitta, spiritual friendship, and that's meaning teacher-student relationship. That's not what I'm alluding to here. I'm talking about kind of like peer spiritual friendship. And what are some of the characteristics of this? So, well, just the first to say is, you know, anytime we have a spiritual friend, somebody with whom we can actually commune over matters of the heart, it's very valuable. It's very valuable. We should not take that for granted. And when you hear people, sometimes I hear people who have been quite isolated or don't have a sangha or don't have spiritual friends. It's poignant to hear that. So even one friend is not a small thing. And, you know, I've found often there's a kind of immediate resonance. There's a sense of like, okay, somehow our hearts speak the same language, you know. But sometimes a very slow burn. There are people that I, you know, consider like very dear friends that we sort of both kind of overlooked each other when we first met for years. It was just like not... I didn't think that friendship was there. And then somehow something happened and it's like, okay, yeah, this is very meaningful. And sometimes it's a kind of long-term friendship, you know, that might go many years, even decades. And sometimes it's beautiful and rich and it has a certain kind of shelf life, you know, where we diverge and the past diverge. We get interested in other things. Something about the dynamic, the intimacy changes. It's okay. It's okay. Nothing said that it has to last forever. Truthfulness is maybe at the heart of this spiritual friendship, to my mind. And dharma, the kind of like the longing to be known in one's truth and to know another, unencumbered by the distorting lenses in our mind, to really, really know another on their own terms. You know, kind of got into this path because I felt like society was not being fully honest about the human condition. You know, I maybe couldn't have articulated it exactly that way, but there was a sense of like we're somehow living alongside some truth and ignoring it, you know, ignoring the first noble truth, ignoring just what it's like to be human, to try to be happy, to be at ease. And spiritual friendship is a kind of shared commitment to truth wherever it leads. That's the nature of the partnership in a way. And in this moment, like the kind of relentlessness of deception and lies and hypocrisy, the ascendancy of greed, hate, and delusion, where I feel like I'm almost being entrained into such madness and lunacy. It's like to keep my moral sanity, spiritual friendships become more urgent, just to come back to a realm of sensitivity and truthfulness and honesty. Gil once said, like, I don't think there's mindfulness practice. I think of it as just honesty practice, you know? In spiritual friendship, the truth of your being is known. It's known. And it feels good no matter what part of us is known, I would say. And like one of the characteristics of a spiritual friendship is that comes like a kind of shorthand of the heart, you know. That's what I notice. Like, you know, if I were to try to explain what I just said to that Dharma friend in one sentence, it would take like an hour, you know, and it probably wouldn't make that much sense to an ordinary civilian, you know. It would just be like, but it's quick. They, you know, and it's like this, of course, in the realms of love or family sometimes, but it's like, this is a friend is like tracking the kind of nuances of your Dharma heart, your pain and your love, carefully, knowing it in one sentence. Okay. I get that. There are some people who know me primarily through my kind of capacity or strength or power or something. And that's good. That's good. That's not a complete picture. But there are other people who know me primarily through my neurosis. You know, we call that family, you know. And they, you know, that's there's that when they discover like that there's anybody on the planet who listens to me, they're like bewildered, you know, just like. But it's not that I feel misconstrued by them. They just know certain aspects of me, you know? And to be known in one's confusion and foibles and be forgiven, that's very, very healing, you know? And spiritual friendship, I would say, is about being both deeply known in one's pain, but also one's power and one's goodness. And there's a kind of, I would say, even though it is very much to be known in one's pain or neurosis, it's the kind of, there's a delight in the goodness of the other. And sometimes, you know, we have to like learn our lovability through the gaze of another. We actually can't do it on our own. And in some sense, we have the best view of ourselves. Like we have the best vantage point, right? But in another sense, we have a very twisted vantage point from which we perceive ourselves. And as a self, the egoic life, egoic life is equivalent to something like imposter syndrome, you know? Like that saying, like, okay, I feel like an imposter. I have this job to do, I have this thing to do, and I don't feel totally like I can't quite do it. I feel like an imposter, right? That's the saying, imposter syndrome. Egoic life is defined by that sense, by the sense that there's some measure of alienation between our life and our self, our ego. And to be a self is to experience that alienation, some measure of imposter syndrome. But a friend is not trying to reify or challenge yourself, but to delight in your paramis, delight in your goodness, to revel in that. And the role of a spiritual friend is really to notice the kind of your ordinary goodness, particularity of your heart. And we start to take that in, you know, to actually take that in and experience ourselves through the eyes of another. What do you look like? You know, it's like sometimes ask that question doing metta practice, like what would, you know, you pick the person, you know, the Dalai Lama or whoever, like, Deepa Ma, what would they see looking into your eyes? A lot of what you're preoccupied with would not even register. A lot of who you think you are, what you think makes you worthy or unworthy, cause for pride or shame, that is completely incidental. We start to learn through the care of another. We kind of graft their care into our understanding of ourselves. I remember one yogi who grew up amidst such pervasive, really unrelenting brutality that when they came into the Dharma, the love was kind of just like unbelievable. The way they put it is like the availability, the accessibility, you know, it was just unbelievable. Couldn't trust it for a long time. Had to test it out. Is this real? Yeah. Just simple care, respect, kindness. Spiritual friendship is very supple about power. Very supple about power. In spiritual friendship, sometimes we are in the role of doctor and sometimes in the role of patient. And those roles move back and forth and we're not keeping tabs. You know, there are relationships, friendships that I have where, okay, for a phase, it was like I was the doctor or I was the patient. But we don't need to keep tabs on it because there's a kind of mutual care and respect and there's a sense of the suppleness of the power dynamic. We don't need to assert ourself or retreat or whatever. It's understood. Power is going to flow through this. We sometimes one person takes the lead, sometimes the other person's the patient. Yeah, fine. No arrogance in being the doctor, no shame in being the patient. In spiritual friendship, there's a kind of shared vision about happiness, that kind of reverence for, you know, we love the same things. We love the same things. And it's very hard. It's very hard, you know. I was at family time with, the kind of broader, more extended family. And some of them want to know, like, what I do. And I was just like, I don't even know where to begin. I don't even know where. I know I'm going to sound like a cult figure, and I know I'm going to, I know there's not going to be understood. It's like there's, so, you know, it takes a long time to have even an inkling what the Buddha means when he says wisdom. Oh, it takes a long time. And, okay, now we both know in a friendship, we both understand the kind of richness and nuances of this path, the richness and nuance of the heart. You know, it takes a long time to understand that. When it is, it's so nourishing to be known together. Friendship is a place where pain gets processed. Sometimes, you know, sometimes with a kind of spouse or partner or loved ones, our pain is too evocative for them to actually metabolize, or the reverse. Their pain is too evocative for us. It spins us, and what masquerades as compassion is really the intolerance of the suffering of the other. And that's a function, in a way, of just how deeply grafted together two lives can be, two, you know, separate beings, but at the level of the model, the self model, no distinction, really. And so the pain becomes a kind of dysregulating force for us. But in spiritual friendship, there's maybe enough space, there's enough differentiation, there's enough, a certain kind of boundary or something that allows, even real intensity to be metabolized. And I'm curious about right speech in this realm, you know? Like, my practice is never to do harm, you know? Like, I'm very careful, like, you know, in speaking to somebody, to be careful with my speech. But in the context of spiritual friendship, and this is an open question for me. Sometimes it feels like venting of one kind or another is needed, you know? And I have like Joseph Goldstein on this shoulder being like, no, Matthew, no. But the thing, not trying to challenge Joseph, but the thing about spiritual friendship that actually makes volatile, kind of intense speech okay, I feel, is that there's a mutual commitment in spiritual friendship to discharge and unburden oneself of the defilements, rather than to speak oneself deeper into their web. Does that make sense? It's like, and for me, you know, it's like, I actually feel like I need to do that. Like, I need sometimes to vent or rant about something, you know, but it's like, in the context of spiritual friendship, I'm very conscious that in a sense, I'm trying to actually hear the holes in my logic, and I'm trying to hear the kind of the dead end of the defilements, even as I act them out, you know? And so there's this kind of dual consciousness where, yeah, there's some energy coming out and whatever. And you're also actually supported by the presence of a spiritual friend to listen to yourself critically too. And so the listener is, you know, the listener is empathic, but they're not fully identified with our story. And we too can train ourselves not to be fully identified with our story, even as we vent. You're actually not trying to shore up your view. And the presence of another person listening very carefully, who knows you well, knows your vulnerabilities, your whatever, that supports us in like creating some metacognitive space that allows us to move through that material and to find ourselves less burdened by the greed, hate, and delusion than before. And in the listening, you know, the listening is primarily empathic, meaning affirming of my experience. But then they're often like, I often get to the end of my paragraph and is like mostly affirm, but in there is like a subtle nudge, you know? It's not much, but it's like it opens a space, and then there's a recognition in me of like, okay, there's delusion here, you know? It's subtle, and it's mostly affirming, and I mostly feel affirmed, but then there's just a little reframe, you know? And so the empathy is not meant to be perfect. It's not meant to be a perfect mirroring. We do this for each other, you know? And this is how we grow. To be known is so good. You know, that's a kind of very primal longing, just to be known, to be understood. We all know how painful, sometimes horrible, it can be to be misconstrued, you know, how desperate we are to correct a misconstrual, you know. And to be known is good. And spiritual friends sometimes in some realms know us more than we even know ourselves. You know, sometimes it's funny to hear, you know, I'm thinking of one friend who sometimes just like observes me in some way, and he is just perceptive in some way. And as soon as he says the thing, I never would have thought it, but as soon as he said it, is like, yeah, that fucker's right, you know. It's right. Yes. You know, a kind of instant dawning of like, I couldn't quite perceive myself, but that Yeah. Agnes Callard. I was talking about Socrates. I've mentioned this, but this is a different passage than I shared, I think maybe a year ago, at a Berkeley Day Long. So she's talking about Socratic dialogue and the kind of necessity of the view of another to understand our own delusion. We cannot do it ourselves. So she writes, we're unable to think about the most important things on our own, and we habitually shield ourselves from this terrifying fact. All of us, and she's a professional philosopher, even professional philosophers, walk around with a conceit of knowledge separating us from other people. Our feeling of basic mental competence of having the answers on which the living of our lives depend keeps us from connecting with others in the ways that benefit us most. Ignorance of ignorance leads us to think that we are to figure out these important questions for ourselves. Ignorance of ignorance prevents us from thinking alongside of another person about what neither of us knows. Ignorance of ignorance is the barrier between us. Socrates dismantled that barrier. Could say spiritual friendship dismantles that barrier. The Quaker tradition, wisdom, I was told, wisdom is considered a property of the group. It's very, I was touched saying that. It's like wisdom is a property of the group because we can't see the back of our head. We need help. We need help. And as Dharma practitioners, we come to delight in the kind of revelation of ignorance, of being surprised by ourselves. Spiritual friends help shine hold up a kind of mirror where we can see ourselves in new light. Sometimes our goodness, sometimes our pain, but in both cases, it's all good news to see more. And you can feel that. And that's part of our Dharma life is the revelation of delusion, of the way some defilement constellates in us. That's good news. It's good news. It's not a cause for shame. It's good news. And we almost develop a kind of taste for the disorientation of being seen more clearly than we see ourselves. Yeah. It's not for faint-hearted, but we develop a taste for the disorientation that comes with the shaking of the egoic ground. And we only can see just how much we've built our home on particular egoic ground. We can only see that when the ground starts to shake. And the ground shaking comes as feedback, one way or another. And the habit, of course, in that disorientation, that kind of radical, this happens a lot in the realm of love and family, and but we can practice this in the realm of spiritual friendship when we're growing. Growing, perceiving ourselves in new ways. And rather than try to reestablish the solidity of the egoic ground, we just open to disorientation. And that is, there's some kinds of learning we simply cannot do ourselves. We cannot do ourselves. We rely on our friends. Spiritual friendship, maybe the last P peace. Spiritual friendship is about play. And Nietzsche famously said that maturity is reacquiring the seriousness of a child at play, you know? And to play, you know, we don't talk about that so much in Dharma, but Dharma's gotta feel quite playful. And not all the time for sure, but sometimes. And the kind of self-seriousness of egoic life allows no play, you know? But play is vital. And so as the kind of in friendship, as the egoic pressure dissolves, it opens up a kind of zone for play. And the denser and more frozen sense of self is, the less room there is to play. But in the realm of friendship, there's a lot of room for play. And a lot, as I reflect, a lot of what I do in, you know, spiritual friendship. And I'm, by the way, I sound like I have like a ton of spiritual friends. I have like four, you know, like, you know, but it's like, it's a lot of what's done in one way or another is playing. And this is, again, this Winnicott, it's in playing and only in playing that the child or adult is able to be creative and use the whole personality. And it is only in being creative that the individual discovers the self, is using the self in a different way. Psychotherapy takes place at the overlap of two areas of playing, that of patient and that of therapist. Psychotherapy has to do with two people playing together. The corollary of this is that where playing is not possible, then the work done by the therapist is directed towards bringing the patient from a state of not being able to play into a state of being able to play. A state of not being able to play into a state of being able to play. And where can we play? Where can we play? Can we play in our pain and neurosis and foibles? Spiritual friendship is part of how we begin to be able to play in more and more zones of our heart mind. So this is this play, this kind of it's a kind of unencumbered by the martial logic of self and the kind of the delight in not needing to curate one's persona, you know, the delight in not needing to hide, the delight in not needing to be, you know, curate the self in some way. And, you know, this is how we, in this play, we start to feel the vigilance drops, you know, such a delight. Maggie Nelson says, related to what I just read, Winnicott's notion of feeling real is so moving to me. One can aspire to feel real. One can help others to feel real. And one can oneself feel real. A feeling Winnicott describes as the collected primary sensation of aliveness. Quote, the aliveness of the body tissues working, of body functions, including the heart's action and breathing, which makes the spontaneous gesture possible. For Winnicott, feeling real is not reactive to external stimuli, nor is it an identity. It is a sensation that spreads. Among other things, it makes one want to live. To feel real, you know. And I don't even know what those associations are for you, to feel real. Maybe that's another way of talking about everything belonging, or maybe that's another way of talking about a kind of being radically known. Known not in the kind of performative dimensions of self, but known in our goodness and desperation. And in the context of spiritual friendship, we help others feel real. And we too are graced with that sense of a certain kind of honor of our inner life feeling real, sensation that spreads and among other things makes us want to live. Just sit for a minute. Just letting the goodness in the room here remind you of your own. And this species of goodness makes us feel more ordinary, less special. Doesn't so much matter whose goodness it is, become sensitized to it. our path is just a progressive sensitization to goodness, taking our cues from there.